Welcome to another edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks so much for tuning in once again as we get the show rolling throughout this summer, and we'll see how long it goes. But we're not going to worry about how long it goes. We're going to enjoy the ride while we're doing it. And we're going to enjoy opening up some packs today. And like I said last week, kind of doing a little twist to the old podcast where we used to just pull one card from a set and talk about that card and about the player. Change it up just a little bit where we open up the packs, talk about the players in the packs a little bit, but also just open up a pack. There's nothing more exciting when you're a collector than opening up that pack and not knowing what's inside. And I've got a nice little stash of packs, bought some from some local card shops recently, had a nice eBay purchase with a gentleman in Illinois who had a whole bunch of cello packs and rack packs from the 1980s and early 90s. So we're going to mix and match, and every week I'm going to put up a Twitter poll at Wax and Gum Stains and basically ask you, all right, which one should we open up? And the top two choices will get opened up and we'll look at them. And I had an interesting trio of packs for this week. We had an 86 Fleer cello pack, an 89 Topps cello pack, and a 91 Donruss Series 2 rack pack. Now, given those three choices, I already knew which two were going to be selected to get ripped into. And there was no surprise here. 72% selected the 86 Fleer cello pack. So that is your runaway leader. 17% went with the 89 Topps pack. And 11% went with the 91 Donruss pack, which is actually a lot more than I thought would go. So we're going to look at the 86 Fleer and 89 Topps cello packs here. The 91 Donruss pack I will open up at a separate time, but a quick little story about that. That's one that I picked up at the local card shop. And if you listen to our podcast on 91 Donruss from a ways back, it was episode 46 with Ken Griffey Jr. as the random pull, you will remember that the 91 Donruss set had a Willie Stargell puzzle. And through wax packs and rack packs, you would collect the puzzle pieces. And I had collected enough Donruss in the late 80s and early 90s to where I had enough puzzle pieces to actually assemble the entire puzzle. Except for that 91 Donruss puzzle, there was the lower right corner of the puzzle. For whatever reason, despite, you know, back then I bought a couple of boxes and I don't know how many packs, I didn't have the lower right corner of the puzzle. And I joked that, you know, much like an uncorrected error, Donruss was probably doing this on purpose. Nobody had the lower right-hand corner of the puzzle. Because honestly, who bought the packs for the puzzle pieces? That's not what you were buying for. So I'm at this local card shop, and he's got one of those, you know, boxes full of just random wax packs. And a lot of them are from the junk wax era. You know, they're three for a dollar. So I'm just kind of combing through here. And he's got about 10 of these Donruss rack packs. And the way that Donruss would package those rack packs, the puzzle pieces were on the back of the packs, the individual packs. So I'm going through this box of just unwanted junk wax era stuff, going, you know, looking at the back of these rack packs, trying to find that one piece. And I found it. That's why I purchased that one rack pack. Not that I was clamoring for 91 Donruss. And like I said, I was pretty certain not too many other people were. But there was that puzzle piece. So finally, 27 years later, I can finally put together that 91 Donruss Willie Stargell puzzle. I've got to find which binder it's in. But I will be gluing that on, and there will be a ceremony. There might be cake for it. Who knows? But yeah, finally managed to get that last puzzle piece 27 years later. And now my work is done. But we'll talk a little more about these specific sets in a little bit. And we'll talk about some of the cards that we pull from the 86 Fleer and the 89 Tops packs in a little bit. But that's the direction we're going in with the show, at least for now. You know, just pulling these packs. And as of now, I've got some going back to, I think, 84 up to 91, I think. So, I mean, we're right in the heart of what people call the junk wax era. And maybe there's some good cards in there, maybe not. But again, just the thrill of opening up the packs. I've always been a pack guy, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait to see what we get from these two sets. Two of my favorite sets from the 80s for different reasons, which I will get to in just a little bit. First, I want to thank everybody who listened into our return episode last week, episode number 103, after a mere nine-month layoff. I do appreciate all the kind thoughts that have come through, whether it's through direct messages or post on our timeline at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. If you could all do me a favor, though, if you could just pass along the word that Wax Ecstatic is back. The word of mouth really works well with this program. That's how it really built up the first go around here. So just simply retweet Wax and Gum Stains, any posts that we put out there. Just tell friends to check it out. And I've always said that it doesn't have to be friends or people that you know who currently collect. It could be somebody who hasn't bought a pack of baseball cards in 30 years, but you still have that connection. You bought some back in the day. A lot of great memories come back with this program, and I certainly want to share that with as many people as possible. So again, just put out the Twitter handle, Wax and Gum Stains, and just say, hey, folks, great show. You got to check it out. Or, hey, Matt's back with the Wax Ecstatic podcast. And I would appreciate that extra little push that you can provide there. Also, thanks to those who made a cash donation via our PayPal site, paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm not one to beg for money. I've never done this podcast looking to make a profit. And I did joke a little bit at the end of the show last week. I said, well, if you give me some money, maybe I'll keep putting this show out. You know, I was somewhat joking. But yeah, there are some production costs, but also there's a cost to obtaining these packs. So any cash donation, whether it's just a couple dollars or if you find it in your heart and your checking account to put in a few more, that also goes to the purchase of some more fancy packs, let's call them. So, you know, if we get the funds to where we can afford to splurge a little bit and pick up a few packs from the early 80s, maybe something from the late 70s, then we'll do that. And we'll all open it together and have some fun with that. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. The podcast is free. It is not free to do. It's a labor of love. It takes a little bit of time to put it all together. And like I said, there are some production costs in terms of basically paying Audio Boom to host the new episodes and also our complete archive. And while we're cleaning up the house here a little bit, as you tell your friends that Wax Ecstatic is back, at least for the summer, let them know there are numerous ways to listen to it. Yes, you can listen to it on Audio Boom, or you can listen to it on Stitcher, you can listen to it on TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Apple iTunes, Blueberry, basically any podcasting service. It's pretty much out there. Just type in Wax Ecstatic on a Google search or, like I said, iTunes, and it will pop up. So again, thanks to everybody who welcomed me back. Like I said, you know, we'll just see how long the show goes. I've got a little bit of downtime in the summer. Things have settled down a little bit at work to where I can afford to do this you know, often early in the morning getting the show together. But, you know, there is a little time to do this. And even though I needed to take a break to take care of other things in my life, it's fun coming back here and doing this again. Because, you know, it's fun just opening up baseball cards and talking about cards and baseball. I mean, what more could you ask for, really? Well, let's get some listener reaction. We've got some great comments and questions that have come in through Wax and Gum Stains. And like I said, it's open 24/7, so feel free to pose any questions or comments or thoughts about the cards, about the show, about the hobby in general, whatever is on your mind. You can go ahead and post it at Wax and Gum Stains, and we will answer several questions in each episode. All right, we'll start off with a couple of comments from Philly Puck Fan, a great avatar too, the 80 Tops Ricky Henderson card there. He mentioned when we were opening up the 81 Tops grocery pack last week, and I was kind of just going on about how they're not very valuable. You know, it's I shouldn't say they're not very valuable. It's not a high price item on eBay. You can still get an 81 Tops grocery pack for a pretty good price. So I was just like, well, you know, this one's been hanging around in my closet for a long time. I think I'll open it. And Philly Puck Fan says, just keep opening them. They make mine rarer. Well, I'm glad I could help out your financial situation there. Hey, you know, it's one small sacrifice for me to pull the Eddie Murray and the Rod Carew and, of course, the Rusty Kuntz rookie card. Just helping the hobby. That's what I'm trying to do. Ryan Mickelson, great to hear your podcast once again. Always enjoyed your approach in discussing cards from days gone by. And hope you decide to continue putting out shows, even if it's not as frequently as before. Well, thank you very much, Ryan. I appreciate your comments. And yeah, we'll keep this train going as long as we can. As long as somebody's listening, we'll go ahead and put something out there. Although I do like consistency and predictability, especially with podcasts, because there's so many of them out there now. If I can tell you, hey, there's going to be a podcast every Friday at noon Eastern, then you're almost like setting your alarm clock to it. You're almost like marking the calendar, you know, hey, we got a new episode coming out every week. So that's going to be my goal, at least for the summer, putting something out on Fridays, probably around noon Eastern, and at least give you something to look forward to before the weekend gets rolling. William King III, I only just got back into baseball cards earlier this year and just discovered your podcast 2 weeks ago and have since listened to every episode you've produced so far. My goodness. Please keep up the amazing work. Well, thank you very much, William. And considering we've had 103 episodes, not including this one, this will be 104. You've got a lot of free time on your hands. But as long as we're entertaining you along the way, I'm glad that we could be a part of your return to the hobby. And I'm curious, William, if you could tell us how you got back into the hobby. I'd like to know that answer because, you know, my story is I really got back. You know, I'd always carried around cards, even though basically from 1993 through, I'd say, 2007, 8, something like that, you know, there was a good 10, 12, 15-year stretch where I just didn't buy anything new. But, you know, I started dabbling back in it again in the mid-2000s. And then, you know, when my son was born and when he was old enough to understand what baseball was and to, you know, understand what baseball cards are. So he would have been about 4 or 5 years old. I started buying packs again and got right back into it. So that's my story. Be curious, William, what your story is. And please share it if you don't mind. Would love to share it with others. Anderson, C.D. Anderson, I should say, pumped you are back, brother. Well, I'm glad to be back. Thank you again for finding the show once again. Our buddy Steve Bowman asking a very interesting question. He says, I will be attending the National Card Show for the first time this year. Well, that is very cool. Congratulations. What's on your wish list? And he puts in parentheses, 1 to 3 cards, less than $100. Interesting parameters, because if I ever found myself at the National Card Show, I would probably have to take out $100 in cash and fully restrict myself to buying just cards with cash. You know, like take out the cash and then leave my wallet in my hotel room and just take the cash with me to the show, because I would be so tempted to just buy up everything there. It's an interesting question, Steve, because I don't really have, you know, certain cards in terms of like a player or even one particular set that I'm looking for. I've never really done that, as strange as that may sound. I've always been a pack guy, always have been a pack guy. And while I'm sure every dealer has boxes and boxes of stuff from the 80s and 90s that they would gladly unload, and you could probably find some good deals, if I was going to the National Card Show where you've got top dealers descending and coming together and, you know, pulling out their best work to sell. I would go for some vintage packs. And if there's one thing that I am kind of sort of looking for right now are unopened wax packs. I mean, it could be cello or rack, but, you know, wax is typically the easiest to get. But unopened wax packs from the mid to early 70s. I have in my personal collection, I have at least one pack of each set, 76, 77, 78, and 79 tops. I don't have 80, but, you know, 80 is relatively easy to get. Likewise, you know, 81 and forward. But I do have my eyes on 75 tops. They're actually, if you find a reputable dealer on eBay, I've seen some that auction off for anywhere between $40 and $60, which to me is a bargain. But if I had to take that $100 in cash and try to pick up two or three gems at like a national card show, yeah, a pack of 75 or 74 tops, once you get into the early 70s and prior, it's a little more difficult. First of all, just because there's only so much product that's still out there. But also, you have the different series of cards. So you're probably looking at a series one or two that's out there because the later series were smaller in number just in production. But that's what I would go for. I would try for 75 tops or earlier. And if I couldn't find it, I would be happy to add more to the 76 through 80 or 80. 81 collection that I have. So good luck at the National Card Show. That's a great question to ask, and I appreciate you listening to the show and supporting it as well. Now, a couple of interesting questions from listeners that address how we do things on the show, and I want to kind of put them all together here just to kind of let you know where I'm coming from and why I do the show the way I do it. First, KevMoke21. Matt, welcome back. I started listening just as you left. Great timing. Glad that you stuck around with us, though. He mentions, I love the podcast. 68 Tops was my first year. Would love to hear episodes on Tops cards 1992 through today. Well, Kev, first of all, 68 Tops, great set. If you get the chance to listen to the podcast we did on 68 Tops featuring Ed Brinkman as our random poll, it was episode number 81. I've got a great story about collecting a lot of 68 Tops a couple of years ago and tying it into the year 1968 in a book about Walter Cronkite that I was reading. 68 Tops is just a great set. And I loved the Tops Heritage set that came out last year that was designed like 68 Tops. So it's one of my absolute favorites. Now, as for episodes on Tops cards from 1992 to today, we do have some older podcasts on 92 and 93 Tops. 92 Tops was, let me see, episode number, where did I put it? There it is, episode 58 with Scott Erickson and his Black Sox. Pedro Martinez in episode 65, that was 93 Tops. So we do touch a little bit on the early 90s Tops. Now, as for mid-90s through today, I may just on a whim pick up some Tops packs here and there just to open them up and discuss them, but really, my passion is not in the current cards. In fact, it's funny that my favorite set of today is Heritage because it's designed like the older cards. And even when I was a kid, even though I was buying new cards, I would still go to flea markets and local card shops and buy cards from the 50s and 60s and 70s just because I thought it was neat to have this piece of history, this piece of cardboard history, if you will. So, Kev, I may break out something from the mid-90s or something current every now and then. But that's not really the niche that I've carved in this show. So I may dabble in it, but I don't know. It would just have to be the right pack at the right time or the right cards at the right time. So not completely closing the door on it, but just wanted to to tell you that not totally keen on it. And I'll explain why with my comment from Doug McCready. Now, Doug talked about what would the five cards be if I had to just pick five from my collection and let the rest go. What would they be? And I mentioned, you know, they're not superstar cards. Well, a couple of them are. But for me, 82 Donruss Cal Ripken, 87 Fleer Barry Bonds, 80 Topps Dave Steeb, 57 Topps Pee Wee Reese, and then a hockey card, the 79-80 Topps Gordie Howe card with the Hartford Whalers. And I had mentioned that, you know, some of these cards don't necessarily have dollar value. Like, through my collection, I have some cards that are worth far more, you know, in book value than the cards that I mentioned. But there is a personal connection to these cards. And Doug mentioned, thanks for answering my question. Great answer is the cards you keep need to have sentimental value more than monetary value. And he mentions his top five would be 78 Whitaker, 77 Fidrich, 71 Rose, 66 Mantle, and 59 Musial, which is absolutely awesome. Now, he also mentions there are still some years in the 50s you didn't go over, talking about past podcast. You don't need to have a card from that year. And then in a direct message, which I won't get into too detailed because it's a private message, but you know, going on about, you know, how I could do shows about cards I don't have. And yeah, you know, I could sit here and tell you about the glamour of the 52 Topps set or 38 Gaudi or the T206 tobacco cards, or like Kev suggested, talking about more current cards. And I could do that. But right now, I'm not going to, and here's why. First of all, I already addressed the current cards. It's not really my passion. I may bring in something from the mid-90s every now and then, or maybe I'll bring up a current card. But, you know, I've discovered in the production of this podcast and through a couple of listener surveys that we've done that dictated the direction of the show, I asked the question, do you want me to talk about current cards? And it was an emphatic no from the people who took the survey. Now, again, that survey was, you know, a year, year and a half ago, so maybe we'll pose the question again at some point in time. But people like looking back at cards from particularly the junk wax era, so 80s and 90s, early 90s, I should say. But also fans have said, yeah, let's go through the 60s and 70s. And that is where the niche is. What makes these cards so special to me, the ones that I do talk about, is that I own them. And it kind of goes back to your comment about, you know, cards shouldn't have the monetary value, they should have that sentimental value. Well, if I have these cards on hand, there is a sentimental value to them. There's a connection, there's a story as to how I got them, there's a story as to why I like them. There's a story about perhaps the players that are featured on them. You know, they bring back either good memories of me watching them or in some cases even meeting them in person. Or sometimes, you know, the older cards that were there before my time. Like I said, when I was a kid, I collected vintage cards. So, you know, it's totally cool for me to talk about a 68 Topps Ed Brinkman, even though I never saw him play. But because I have some kind of neat little story or connection to these particular cards. So when it comes to older cards, like I said, you know, 52 Topps. Yeah, I could basically give you the history of 52 Topps, but that would be called an audiobook because there are plenty of books and articles about the 52 Topps set that me just pontificating about it, while for some people might be entertaining, you know, it's really just me just talking about facts of a particular card, which I don't know about you, but it's not all that crazy interesting to me. You know, I can sit here and we're going to do this in just a couple of minutes, you know, an 86 Fleer pack, an 89 Topps pack. You know, I collected those as kids. 89 Topps in particular, I have a very strong pull to because that was the set that introduced me to card collecting. As you may have heard in our previous episode on 89 Topps, I told the whole story about how I went grocery shopping with my mother and she asked me, hey, do you want to buy some packs of cards? Because they were just on sale. They were there. I said, yeah. And that's how it started. Episode 33, by the way, in our archives with Tim Raines. So, you know, 89 Tops, I've got a very special feeling for. 86 Fleer, I've always loved that set. So even if there's nothing but common cards, and even if you can go out and buy a cello pack of each of these for a dollar or two, you know, there's a passion, there's excitement, there's energy that I can provide with that, as opposed to just going, boy, the 52 top set is really nice. So, I appreciate the comments and suggestions, both Doug and Kevin, anybody else. I mean, you're more than welcome to say, well, why don't you do this? Or I'd like for you to do that. And I will certainly take all suggestions into consideration. But, again, maybe I do come across a lot of 55 and 56 Topps cards one day and I buy them and that gets added to my collection. Then I can talk about them a little bit. But, I don't want to just talk about a card just to talk about a card. You know, there's got to be a story behind it. There's got to be a pull behind it, some kind of connection that I can make that makes the storytelling even better. And that's what we're about to do here with these packs. So thanks again to everybody who commented this week. Again, Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter feed. Post your comments, questions, concerns, suggestions, what have you there. And we'll look through the mailbag, if you will, every week to discuss it. All right, let's look at these cards here. Like I said, our runaway winner was 86 Fleer, one of my favorite sets. Fleer, really, after stumbling out of the gate in 1981 and 82, I've always felt that 1983 through 87 was Fleer's best time. Much better card stock, really good selection of rookie cards, first-year cards for players, great designs, too. And the best thing is, nowadays, here we are 30 to 35 years displaced from that era. You can still get Fleer cards and packs at really good prices. You can get 83 Fleer cello packs. I saw something on eBay. Somebody was selling five for, I think, $10 or $12. I mean, you're looking at $2 to $3 per pack if you include shipping. That's a hell of a deal. And yeah, there's probably just five or six cards in particular from each set that are real money makers. The obvious ones, Boggs and Sandberg and Gwynn and Mattingly and Puckett and Clemens and Ripken. But it's a really good value, especially the cello packs, because if you do get five of them, that's a little over 100 cards and, pretty good investment just for, like I said, $10 or $12 in that case. But 86 Fleer was always one of my favorite business sets, if you will, very representative of the 80s. Not as good as some of the top sets that were coming out at the time, but I really thought Fleer was in its groove in the mid-80s. And then they kind of went back and forth between good and bad, in the late 80s and early 90s. But 86, it's right in the wheelhouse, and it's a great set. As I mentioned, 89 Tops, very sentimental to me. I'll always like 89 Tops. And I'll especially enjoy looking at this design. I've called it an all-American design. You've got the Dodgers script, if you will, or the Late Night with David Letterman script at the bottom. The player name featured in the tail of the last letter of the team name. A lot of white border there, but some pretty good action shots, crystal clear shots, and a very unique color combination on the back. Reminiscent of the 69 Tops set, although not as vibrant, but you've got the black border, which can be problematic for some collectors, obviously. The black border and the two shades of pink that were used as the background. But again, because I started my collecting career with this and had a lot of these cards from day one, I'm always connected to 89 Tops, and I absolutely love it. So this is where we click over to the video link, which was included in the original tweet that went out. And you can listen to the pack open. I will be doing that as well. So you can listen to it. You can just keep the podcast right where it is, and we'll just open up the packs. Or you can, at some point in time, click on the video link if you haven't already and see us break into these packs. Hopefully, I've made a couple of adjustments here. Because I'm using a microphone on a camera, it's going to sound a little different than the rest of the podcast. But I've made a few adjustments to where I think it'll sound a little better, not quite as echoey as last week. So let me head on over to the table here. Let's open up some packs. All right, so we've got our three packs here that were up in the poll. And like I said earlier, no surprise, the results. People far and wide wanted the 86 Fleer. A pretty good portion wanted 89 Tops. And then a better than expected return, 11% of the vote for the Donruss 91 pack. I just have the pack, even though it didn't win. I just want to show you. Here's that puzzle piece I've been waiting 27 years for, so I can finally finish that damn thing. But I'll open that up and look through that some other time. Now, before we get to the 86 Fleer, I'm actually going to open up the 89 Tops first. And again, there's a sentimental reason why I like the 89 Tops. It was the first baseball card that I ever bought. You know, my mother offered to buy packs, and I got some. Now, those were wax packs, but I always have a sentimental attachment to 89 Tops, even though it is a fairly overproduced set, and, you know, there's not too many big star cards. Randy Johnson rookie card is a big one. Another, you know, you got a lot of star cards like Barry Bonds and Jose Canseco, those are pretty big, but that's about it. Of course, you have the stiff gum there, so we'll toss that aside. My buddy, the crime dog, Fred McGriff, leading off this 89 top cello pack. Let's see what else we got. Pete Stanichek of the Orioles. Mike Lavalle, Spanky Lavalle. We featured him in an 88 score podcast last year. Dewey, Dwight Evans, near the end of his career here. Look at that impressive list of stats on the back of the card there. A very underrated player for the Red Sox for many, many, many years. Of course, you think of the Red Sox of the late 70s and early 80s. You think of Carlton Fisk. You think of Roger Clemens, Jim Rice. Dwight Evans, often overlooked. Mean Gene Nelson of the Oakland Athletics. We've got Jose Bautista of the Baltimore Orioles. Look at that, a Jose Bautista rookie card. Of course, that would go on for a pretty lengthy big league career. My favorite ball player when I was a kid, Dave Steeb. Great action shot in the old powder blue unis for the Blue Jays. I know what this card is. We're going to get there, but that's one of the few good cards from the 89 Top set, more valuable cards. Howard Johnson, the hotel magnate, if you will. Going Hojo for the Mets, the last, you know, before David Wright came around, the last star third baseman for the Mets. And of course, Wright's been dealing with a lot of back injuries over the last several years, but you know, the Mets in their 50, how long have they been around now? 56 years? Yeah, I'm trying to do math very quickly. 56-year history have always been trying to nail down that star cornerstone at third base. And Hojo was as close as they got in the 80s. No, it wasn't Tom Glavin. I was just kidding you. Joe Baver of the Atlanta Braves. Steve Lake of the Cardinals. We got Dennis Oil Can Boyd, and actually using his given name instead of his nickname. Funny story about Dennis Boyd, I'll get to in just a few minutes. The Nasty Boy, Rob Dibble, the closer of those wild and crazy Reds teams, a rookie card for him. Robin Yount, showing us how to do the proper bunt. We've got Sil Campusano of the Blue Jays. The company store card, I'm going to get to this in a little bit. I'm going to put that down there. Frank Dipino of the Cubs. We got Craig Worthington of the Orioles. Floyd Yeomans of the Montreal Expos, a Tampa native. Highly sought after future prospect, had a lot of potential, drafted by the Mets. Didn't quite live up to all the hype. I believe part of the Gary Carter trade in 1984. Candy Sierra. One of the best names of baseball at the time, or a top 40 dance artist, but definitely one of the two. Mike McFarlane with the Royals, dutifully going through a stack of bats in the dugout. We've got Trevor Wilson of the Giants. There's old Pudge right there with the White Sox, with that scowl that he was famous for. And I personally saw that scowl up close when I was a kid. That was real. That was real red ass right there. Brian Holton of the Dodgers. We've got Ray Quinones of the Mariners. Your Cardinals leaders there. John Davis of the White Sox. Cecil Espy of the Texas Rangers with the All-Star Rookie Cup. Steve Lombardozzi of the Twins. Jeff Hamilton of the Dodgers. And the speedster, Vince Coleman, before he was in trouble with the Mets all the time with the Cardinals. The company store card, I'm going to elaborate on this in just a little bit. Just because I only have so much time to go through the 86 Fleer, but I'm always amused when I see these in the late 80s Topps cards. All right, the 86 Fleer pack, the big card here, the Jose Canseco rookie card. Also, Andres Galarraga, Benny Santiago with rookie cards in here. I always love the 86 Fleer design here, and you can get these relatively inexpensive now. Andy Van Slyke with the Cardinals, a lot of people remember him best from his days with the Pirates, but there he is with St. Louis, the team that drafted him back in the early 80s. Mike Bielecki of the Pirates, the Pirates wearing down and out of the pillbox hat, the 1970s uniforms. Luis Aguayo of the Phillies. We've got Senor Smoke, Juan Berenguer of the Tigers, Ozzie Virgil of the Phillies. That's a great t-shirt that he's wearing, too. Bruce Sutter in his, not the swan song, he would have a few more seasons left, but in the Atlanta Braves wearing that classic powder blue uni. The checklist card. Let's see, this it's not as bad as the manager card. It's not as great as the team picture card, but yeah, you know, you pay all your money for, how many cards came in here? 28 cards. And this is one of them. Yawn. I guess the one highlight is that you've got your 1985 World Series combatants on the front and your Championship Series combatants to Toronto and the Mets. The Mets didn't make it to the NLCS. They just had a higher winning percentage than the Cardinals, or they were the second best team in winning percentage. That's how Fleer put together their cards back. Then you would have the best team up front and then the worst team in the back. Tim Lawlor with the Boston Red Sox. We got Chris Bando with the Indians. And of course, the Indians going back to the Block C look as not by choice, but Major League Baseball getting rid of Chief Wahoo there. And I'll talk a little more about that, but I'm actually not all that opposed to that. I know Indians fans are going to flay me for that, but Craig Lefferts with the Padres. And, you know, it's funny, we were looking at the 81 Topps grocery pack, and there was a player that was wearing the batting practice or spring training jersey, which back in the early 80s was the bright yellow with the S&D. This one's not so bad either. I wasn't a big fan of this uniform back in the 80s, but I've come around to it a little bit. It's synonymous with Tony Gwynn, of course. I think that's why a lot of people actually like what the Padres ownership has called the poop brown look of late. Scott Fletcher with the White Sox in there, as Paul Lucas would call it, beach party blanket bingo uniforms. You got Ron Meredith of the Cubs. Tippy Martinez for the Baltimore Orioles. Here's a little quirk, a backwards inserted card. Tim Corcoran of the Phillies. I think I know why that quirk is, because there should have been a sticker there. You got two stickers with the 86 Fleer pack, so a little bit of a packaging error there. So we get the bonus card. Well, that makes up for the checklist, so we'll take that. Now, what I do love about this sticker, and I've always loved Fleer stickers, the Seattle Mariners sticker is epic because you have the modified trident look here, which they wore from 1981 through 1986. They would switch it up to the blue and gold look with the stylized S, you know, made popular with Ken Griffey Jr. But I absolutely love this logo. This may be my favorite Mariners logo of all time. And the stickers back then came with trivia facts on the back. Denny Walling of the Houston Astros. We got Juan Beniquez of the Angels. Jeff Lottie of the Cardinals. Steve Farr of the Royals. The Penguin, Ron Say with the Cubs. of course, most famous in his years with the Dodgers. Eddie Milliner with the Reds. Don Carmen of the Phillies. Murph! Good old Dale Murphy wearing that classic Braves uniform. That's a great shot of him in the batting cage. Jose Guzman of the Texas Rangers. Got the Chicken Man, Wade Boggs, just in the prime of his career here in 1986. Bob Stanley of the Red Sox. Look at that, Tony Gwynn. We were just talking about him, and he's wearing that same shirt there. So that's a nice one. Bob James, the pitcher, not the jazz artist, of the Chicago White Sox. And then Otis Nixon, always looking like he's up to no good. And chances are, he wasn't. So there's our look at the 86 Fleer and the 89 top Celipacs. Thank you for everybody who got their votes in. We'll talk about a few of the cards that are in here and also this goofy gem as we continue the show here in just a second. All right, back at the good microphone here, and some very interesting cards in these sets here. Now, last week I went through every card in the 81 Topps pack. You know, no Rusty Kuntz here, but some very interesting cards. And this Topps Company store card, these were inserted in packs of 88, 89, and 90 Topps. And I've always wondered, did anybody actually buy this stuff? Because if memory serves correct, there was actually some interesting things that were offered up here. But again, you weren't opening up these packs in the hopes of buying a Topps t-shirt. But, you know, there were some interesting things. Like there were t-shirts, there were sweatshirts, I think. I think there was like a glossy card offer as well, a glossy set. But this might be the goofiest of all company store cards. And it reads, Topps baseball cap with Topps plush fur ball. And that's trademarked, by the way, F-U-R-R-B-A-L-L, fur ball, which goes well with a Charlie Furbush rookie. I saw Furball and Furbush on Spectrovision once. Great lighting. Furball will adhere to visor or blue panels or can easily be removed for throwing. Adjustable. One size fits all. To order, send check, no cash, for $6.95 plus $1 postage and handling, $7.95 total, plus any three 1989 special offer cards, your name, age, address, and zip code too, and there's the address. Allow up to 8 weeks for shipment, you know, in the days of Amazon Prime, 8 weeks for furball? Offer good while supplies last. Hurry, time's a-wasting. Void where prohibited, taxed, or regulated. Offer good in USA only. And it mentions here, by purchasing this offer, you will automatically be entered into the sweepstakes. Print your name and address and space provided on the reverse side of this card. And the sweepstakes, of course, something that Topps did for many years in the 80s and early 90s, the trip for four to a spring training camp of the team of your choice, which for me growing up in Tampa was the biggest waste of promotional effort because we had like 10 teams spring training around here at the time. But I'm curious, did you or somebody you know actually buy anything from the Topps store? Because we're living in a day and age now where, you know, what's old is new again. And even I have a Topps shirt. You know, it's a new shirt. It wasn't from the 80s. But it's a shirt that has the old 1970s Topps logo on it. And, you know, it's kind of cool. You know, I think people would like to wear that stuff. I'm wondering if there is a warehouse in Westbury, New York that has all these old Topps furball hats and t-shirts and sweatshirts and other nonsense that they were selling back then. I'm wondering how much of this product did they actually move? Couldn't have been that much because I don't ever recall seeing anybody wearing anything that was featured on these Topps Company store cards. All right, let's look through some of the select cards from 89 Topps. The leadoff hitter, if you will, Fred McGriff. You know, I'm not starstruck, and because I deal with athletes on a daily basis in my job and have for many, many years, you know, I don't get too attached to too many players. It's just part of the job. But I am fortunate to call Fred a friend of mine. I've known him for many years. We used to co-host a radio show together back in the mid-2000s here in Tampa. Good guy, scouting for the Braves nowadays, and I actually caught up with him about a year ago. We bumped into each other. It was great seeing him again. But Fred McGriff, I don't know why this guy is not in the Hall of Fame. I mean, he only had 493 home runs. He led his respective league in home runs a couple times in his career. Was overshadowed by some other outstanding first baseman, you know, in particular, Don Mattingly in the 80s. But you also had, you know, infielders who eventually moved around to first base. I'm talking about like George Brett and Rod Carew. You know, he never quite got the due he was deserved. You know, playing in Toronto, even though the Blue Jays were a good team in the 80s, you know, they got overshadowed by some of the bigger teams. San Diego later, certainly winding down his career with two stints with the Devil Rays in the early 2000s. You know, I'm always going to bang the drum for Freddie McGriff. I think he should be in the Hall of Fame, but I just have no idea why he's not there. And unfortunately, he's probably going to be one of those Veterans Committee selections because, yeah, he's on the ballot only a couple more times, I believe. But Freddie's good people, and it's great to see this card leading off. The Mike Lavalle, you know, we actually did a podcast on him. I mentioned it was 88 score not that long ago, episode number 24. And, you know, Spanky was his nickname. Not known for his offense, but he was one of the best defensive catchers in the big leagues at the time, overshadowed by the star players, the killer bees of Bonds and Bonilla and some of the pitchers of the Pirates in the late 80s. It mentions here on the back of his card, Mike played center on his college hockey team. That's actually not a big surprise here. Even though he was called Spanky and he was kind of known for his girth, shall we say, he wasn't like this hulking tank. He was only 5'10", 190 pounds, which for a hockey center is kind of the average size there. Dwight Evans, as I mentioned, you talk about overshadowed by some of the great players. You know, I also left Fred Lynn off the list. You know, Dwight Evans is a guy who had a spectacular career, and you know, even he's not on the Hall of Fame roster either, which is a bit of a surprise because he had 385 home runs, over 2,400 hits in a 20-year career. He's one of those bubble guys, kind of like Tim Raines was. But I think what really pushed Tim Raines over the hill was you know, the love for the Montreal Expos, and you know, everybody. That's why, you know, while I think that Raines was deserved, although barely, of a Hall of Fame induction, I think a lot of it was just people clamoring to see the old, you know, red, white, and blue unis in the Hall of Fame. You know, there was just this fevered pitch of passion from the Montreal Expos, and of course Jonah Carey and his you know, efforts to get Raines in the Hall of Fame there. Dwight Evans is kind of in the same boat, or was. He's not eligible anymore. But you know, this is a guy who what really impresses me is his longevity. He was still, even in the late 80s and up until his retirement in 92, I think it was, and he finished his career in Baltimore, but that guy could still mash. I mean, even looking at the back of this card, let me see, in 88, he appeared in 149 games, hit 21 home runs, 111 RBI, and had a .293 batting average. I mean, this guy was not petering out at the end. He was doing pretty darn good. So there you go. Dwight Evans, I've always had mad respect for him, a guy that doesn't quite get the respect that he is due. And, you know, he's still very popular with Red Sox fans. Jose Bautista, Now, this is the relief pitcher, not Joey Bats that everybody knows and love. But Jose Bautista did have a very good career, the pitcher again. A relief pitcher, played, I believe, 9 seasons. Wasn't a spectacular pitcher, but had some decent numbers. And speaking of longevity, he was able to put in quite a few years with Baltimore, as seen here, but also Chicago. The Giants kind of bounced around a couple teams afterwards. What's interesting about Jose Bautista is he's from the Dominican Republic and he's Jewish. And that is a very, very small sample of the population of the Dominican Republic. There's that joke in the movie Airplane. Do you have something lightery? Well, here's this pamphlet of, Jewish Hall of Famers or, famous Jewish athletes or whatever. This would be a pamphlet, the number of Jewish athletes from the Dominican Republic. I think Jose Bautista is probably the only one. Dave Steeb, again, my favorite player, had the chance to meet him back in spring training of 1991. Did an entire show, episode 102, on him and that story, so you can check that out when you get the chance. Talked a little bit about Howard Johnson, a stud third baseman for the Mets. Also, the Tigers, don't forget, that's the team that actually drafted him back in, what was it, the late 70s, I believe. He's also a local from the Tampa area, as he was born in Clearwater. Howard Johnson actually was drafted by the Yankees, didn't sign with the Yankees, and then signed with the Tigers. But, he was the guy who could mash as well, had a breakout season in 87 after winning a World Series with the Tigers in 84 and the Mets in 86. And he's one of those guys whose career just went down very, very quickly. What was it, around 1990, I want to say. His numbers just fell off the table, and he bounced around for a few years and had a very lengthy career as a hitting coach, and first with the Mets, also in the Mariners system. He's been moving around the minor leagues as a hitting coach. Dennis Oil Can Boyd. It's funny. I actually read a tweet a couple days ago from Roger Bennett, one of the co-hosts of Men with Blazers, the soccer podcast and TV show. And he mentioned, Men with Blazers, they're doing a show in Boston. And he said, I'm really excited to be in Boston. He said, my first memory of Boston was going to a Red Sox game. Oil Can Boyd was pitching, and that just floored me. And I had to ask him. He has an answer, but I had to ask him. I said, was Rich Gedman catching? I mean, Dennis Boyd is one of those names that just comes lurching out at you, and especially because it is his birth name of Dennis and not Oil Can Boyd, which, the nickname was used on several cards. It says on the back of this card, his father, Willie, once played for the Homestead Grays of the Negro League. And I'm always reminded of a question. I think our buddy Peter Steinberg brought this up in an episode a long, long time ago, asking which is the better nickname, Oil Can Boyd or Catfish Hunter. And while Jim Catfish Hunter certainly had better career numbers, I had to go with Oil Can Boyd because Oil Can was kind of a nickname for rot gut whiskey in his native Mississippi. And, anything that's related to rot gut whiskey, you've got to love that as a nickname. The Nasty Boy, Rob Dibble. This guy was a red ass. Remember when he got into a fight with Lou Piniella in the Reds locker room? It wasn't the only fight that he got in. He had a nasty temper, and that was actually part of what made him such a successful pitcher. A little bit like Mitch Williams, wild thing, because he was all over the place with his pitches. Rob Dibble, who was generously listed as 6'4", 225 pounds on the back of this card, he went up there with an attitude and kind of had that Koufax feel to him, or not Koufax, Don Drysdale. He went up there, he had this big hulking frame and a nasty fastball, and he would brush it back off the plate. He had no fear of that. Rob Dibble would later become a radio host. In fact, that's what he's doing nowadays. teamed up with Dan Patrick when Dan Patrick was starting his radio days with ESPN. Now, Dan was in radio before he started working for ESPN, but I'm thinking back to the mid to late 90s. But that's rather apropos because Dibble's dad, Walt, was a news director in Hartford, Connecticut at the Big D, WDRC, and later WTIC, the longtime home of the Hartford Whalers. Robin Yount, what can you say about this guy? I mean, you know, with Paul Molitor, they were the faces and the heart and the soul of the Milwaukee Brewers and Harvey's Wallbangers and all those great Brewers teams from the late 70s and early 80s. One of my absolute favorite players from that time. Floyd Yeomans. He was an interesting guy. Like I said, he was a part of the Gary Carter trade. So an interesting story behind him. He was a friend of Doc Gooden. Both Floyd and Doc grew up in Tampa, played for West Tampa Little League. And Doc gets drafted and starts his ascendancy to a star career. And meanwhile, Floyd gets drafted. And all of a sudden, though, there are instant comparisons. And he was drafted by the Mets, too. Let's not forget that. So everybody's thinking, okay, Doc and Floyd, boyhood buddies, came up through the minor leagues in the early 80s together with the Mets. They're going to be teammates. They're going to be fireballers. Well, he is part of the package that's sent to Montreal for Gary Carter. Of course, Gary Carter was loved by the Expos fans. So Floyd Yeoman's career was basically dented before it even started, because no matter how good of a prospect he was, no matter how good Hubie Brooks and Mike Fitzgerald and Herm Winningham were, they were never going to be Gary Carter. And it proved out that even though he had a couple of decent seasons, in particular the 86 season was his best, won 13 games, struck out 202 batters, he had to battle, you know, the backlash of being the guy or one of the guys traded for Gary Carter. He was a cocaine user, got in trouble with Major League Baseball, got suspended. His career ended, I want to say, in like 1990, and he could never get back into baseball. And Floyd Yeomans, if you're wondering, is living in, at last check, Nashville. He's an Uber driver, and there are some interesting stories about him. And, you know, he realizes his struggles. He realizes he screwed up a very good thing with his drug use, but you know, he's still out there paying the bills and paying dearly for some of the mistakes that he made. But such a tragic story. A guy with so much talent that got derailed first by his fault and then just being one of the pieces of a very big trade that didn't work out for the team that traded one of its star players. Carlton Fisk, like I mentioned, the scowl. I got to meet Carlton Fisk. Talk about a red ass. In that same spring training game in 1991 where I met Dave Steeb, and, you know, long story short, Carlton Fisk just basically gave me the cold shoulder when me, the honorary bat boy of the game, tried to get his bat after he struck out. That was ill-advised on my part. Cecil Espy, I've always loved Cecil Espy cards. They're right up there with Odibby McDowell. The Texas Rangers had some very strange names on their roster back in the mid-80s. But Cecil Espy, who was, you know, a utility outfielder, played, I don't know, five or six seasons in the big leagues. It's so funny. He's got the Topps All-Star Rookie Cup on here. Even though he went 4 years between major league appearances, he was with the Dodgers for 20 games in 83, bounced around the minor leagues, and then came back up, resurfaced in 87. In 1988, he played 123 games, had a .248 batting average, yet Topps desperately trying to reach out there and declare somebody a future star. So somehow stuck the gold cup on Cecil Espy's card. But, you know, Espy, I've always thought the ESPN Espy Award should somehow work Cecil Espy into the program. I don't know if you like secretly etch his image on like the bottom of the trophies that they hand out, or it would be really something if Cecil Espy came out to present an award every year. Because, I mean, what a great name. Cecil Espy. Sounds like a medical condition, too. Oh, he fell down the stairs. What happened? Well, you know, he had a Cecil Espy episode. Oh, no. He's going to have to see a neurologist about that. Finally, from the 89 Tops pack, Vince Coleman. Again, another great talent. Unfortunately, attitude issues, getting run over by the rain tarp during the playoffs. You know, that hampered his career and the Cardinals' World Series hopes back then. So there's the 89 Tops. Let's look through a couple of the 86 cards here. We've got Andy Van Slyke leading off here. And Van Slyke, you know, another one of those guys, much like Mike LaValle, who was overshadowed by all the star players in Pittsburgh. Of course, he was a star himself in St. Louis, very speedy outfielder, a guy who made a lot of highlight reel catches as well, and has also moved on to the coaching realms too. He was in Seattle for a little bit, also Detroit. Is an author too, has written several books, of course, baseball focused as well. And he's got some kids who are involved in sports as well. Scott Van Slyke played for the Dodgers. Let's see, A.J. Van Slyke played college ball. Where'd he go? I think Kansas. Was also a member of the Cardinals for a while. And he had a son who also played football. Jared Van Slyke was a defensive back for Michigan. So the athletic genes run deep in the Van Slyke family. Juan Berenguer, one of my favorite nicknames, Senor Smoke. He had a really impressive fastball here pictured with the Detroit Tigers. Played for a lot of teams during a very lengthy career. He was in the bigs for, I think, 13 or 14 seasons. But an outstanding relief pitcher. And he's one of those guys that definitely goes under the radar all these years later, but he was very effective, had a career earned run average of 3.90, a win-loss record of just above 500, but he was a guy that you could count on coming out of the pen. Certainly helped out the Tigers in 84, the Twins in 87, winning World Series, and ironically, was a relief pitcher for the Braves when they lost to the Twins in 91. But I remember watching him still dealing smoke back then. Talking about athletic genes, Berenguer's son Chris played in the United States Hockey League in Sioux Falls, which, you know, may seem a little odd because Berenguer is from Panama City, Panama, not Florida. But he settled into life after baseball in Minnesota, and that's partially how Chris found his way onto the rink. Bruce Sutter, the Hall of Fame closer, who finished his career with 300 saves on the nose and a really, really bad shoulder. Years of relief pitching just shredded his arm. But National League Cy Young Award winner in 1979, World Series winner with the Cardinals in 1982. Like I said, finishing up his career with the Braves in the late 1980s. Great hair, awesome beard as well. You know, this was your typical bushy-looking relief pitcher from the 1980s. And a guy, too, you know, we talk about how with pitching staffs being used the way that they are nowadays, you know, the day of or the age of the starter changing, you know, I don't know if we'll ever have a starter have 10 complete games again or if we'll have a 300-win pitcher. You know, I think Clayton Kershaw, you know, is going to be an exception. There's two or three players now who might get to that plateau. But, you know, it goes the same for relief pitchers. Granted, you have saves still and you still call on a closer. But the way that pitching staffs are used now, it's not only or not always just one guy, a defined closer. So the days of 300 saves or more, you know, the Lee Smiths and the Dennis Eckersleys and, of course, you know, Troy Percival, Trevor Hoffman, Mariano Rivera. I'm curious as to how many more of those 400 plus save guys you're going to have nowadays. The checklist card, I tried to say this when the camera was on, but it kind of came spitting out the wrong way. FLIR would organize, and they did this, I think, for the first 10 or 11 sets. FLIR organized their cards by winning percentage, and you always had the World Series winner as the first team. So in 86, Kansas City was the first team, followed by the Cardinals, then the Blue Jays. Now, the Cardinals played the Dodgers in the 85 NLCS, not the Mets. But the Mets had a higher winning percentage, so they were the fourth team in order there. And I always thought that was a pretty unique way of putting things together. Looking at this Mariners card, the sticker, I love that modernized trident. And I love, too, that the Mariners are acknowledging their past a bit. You know, they've had their current color scheme and uniform scheme for basically 25 years now. They've had that teal and silver, which still all these years later looks good, but it also looks all these years later. It looks like it's been around since 1993. So I love how they have worked into their uniforms, the Sunday uniforms now, at least at home. The blue and gold has come back. You know, they keep the same typeface, but they brought back the color scheme. But also the cream color of the uniform and the no name on the back, that is actually a throwback to the 69 Seattle Pilots. I think that's great. And they've also incorporated the trident, the original trident, and then the modernized trident into spring training and batting practice uniforms. Ron Say, the Penguin, so named because of how he walked. He kind of had a little waddle to him. He was a short guy, too, 5'9", 185 pounds. Best known for his time with the Dodgers, and he still works for the Dodgers, but he had some productive seasons with the Cubs, helping them get to the 84 NLCS against San Diego, finishing his career with Oakland. A lot of people don't know about that, but he played one season, 1987, with the Oakland Athletics. Dale Murphy, who follows this podcast, I don't know if he actually listens, but at least the person who runs his social media account, if it's not Dale, does. So Murph, if you're listening, thanks for hanging in there. Absolutely love this card and the Murphy jersey. I've got this jersey. It's one of my favorites. I was never an Atlanta Braves fan, but loved that powder blue jersey from the 80s. I also love the Braves logo at the time, the Chief Nakahoma, which, you know, nowadays is politically insensitive. And I get it. I understand how people wouldn't like it. But there is a really neat feel to that logo. It's not all that different from what the Pirates had back in the 80s, kind of the wanted poster, you know, Errol Flynn pirate look that they had. But that also brings up, you know, the Indians. And I mentioned this with one of the cards. Which one was it? I go shuffling through the pack here. I mean, I got a couple of Indians cards. Oh, the Chris Bando one. You know, the Major League Baseball is making the Indians slowly phase out Chief Wahoo. And back in the day, I would have been, well, you know, hey, you know, what's so wrong with this? But, you know, you grow a little older, you grow a little wiser, and I can totally see how Chief Wahoo offends people. And quite honestly, you know, I'm okay with Wahoo going away if the Indians stay with the block letter C. Now, you open up another can of worms. Do the Indians get rid of that nickname? That gets to be a real sticky situation. But if I was told, if I was the owner of the Cleveland Indians and I was told, okay, you have to get rid of the nickname too, I would go with the Cleveland Buckeyes, which was the name of their Negro League team. But also, I mean, it's the Buckeye State, and you kind of usurp away a little bit of power from Ohio State. So, just throwing that out there. Wade Boggs, Chicken Man, as I said, got his 3,000th hit with the Devil Rays. First player to do it via home run. But he was just at his absolute best here in 86. And he was, even though I was never a Yankees fan, when the Yankees won the World Series in 96 and he was playing third base, I was a huge fan of Wade Boggs, and so happy that he was able to finally win a World Series. He's an interesting personality. Let me just say that. I got to briefly brush into him at a party he was hosting for his Hall of Fame induction back in, 2005, I believe it was. And interesting dude. I'll just say that. Also an interesting dude, and we're talking about PSA-worthy cards. Yeah, this is one I may run up the ladder. Tony Gwynn, much like Boggs here, a fourth-year card. And here he is, you know, striking a pose with a half swing, wearing that poop brown Padres uniform, the batting practice uniform that, you know, like I said, I've come around to over the last few years. I kind of like that late 80s brown and orange look that the Padres have. And so sad that we lost Tony not that long ago, just a few years ago, at such a young age. You know, it was really sad that he never won a World Series. He was on both of the Padres' World Series teams in 1984 and 1998. 3,000 hits, Hall of Famer, incredible hitter. I mean, you've seen the stories about how he owned even great pitchers like Greg Maddux. And always a smile on his face, always seemed like he had a lot of fun. You know, a California native, was Mr. Padre, always will be Mr. Padre. And it's just so unfortunate we lost him at such a young age. And, you know, that's one of the players who, because he was in San Diego, living on the East Coast, you didn't see too many Padres games on the television. And this is before the days of MLB extra innings. You know, you were basically counting on either the Padres being on national television, which was a rarity, or they were playing your favorite team. So I didn't get to see him too much, but the games I did see Gwynn play, quite the sight to behold. And finally, Otis Nixon, like I said, not looking like he's up to anything good, and he probably wasn't. You know, another talent, not quite of the echelon of a Vince Coleman, but you know, certainly not as good of a hitter, but could have had a pretty good career on the base paths had he not gotten involved in cocaine. And it's still something that he's been battling with even after his playing career. In fact, just a few years ago, he was pulled over and arrested for having a crack pipe and crack in his car. So there you go, 86 Fleer, 89 Tops, absolutely love, you know, looking through some of these packs here. And we'll put up another round of packs, probably on Monday. I don't know what we'll do. Like I said, I've got a box of these packs. I'll just mix and match, or maybe I'll do several from the same year and let you guys pick. And then we will rip open into these and look at them next week. So that'll wrap up our program this week. Again, Wax Ecstatic is back, at least for this summer, and we encourage your comments at Wax and Gum Stains. And also, again, any support that you can with a little cash donation is always appreciated at paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for your questions and your comments and your suggestions, and for ripping through these packs, just going through some great old baseball cards here. And we will do it again next week on Wax Ecstatic.